In his brief letter, Jude alludes to an apocryphal story in which the archangel Michael disputes with Satan regarding the body of Moses. In a recent retelling of that tale, Michael threatens to sue the devil, and it caused Satan to double over in laughter. Michael says, "What are you laughing at?" And Satan says, "Where are you going to find a lawyer?" Some of you will get that later. Lawyers are often the targets of suspicion and sarcasm and scorn, as are politicians who, by and large, start off as lawyers. Many Christians seriously wonder if a believer can enter either one of these professions and maintain their integrity. Certainly, the landscape is littered with the wreckage of promising young men and women who began with good intentions but were corrupted along the way. Maybe it's better just to avoid those arenas altogether, we might conclude. And I think that would be listening to Satan's counsel. I believe we need more committed Christians in these arenas in our times, not less. The reason why so many bad people run the show is because there aren't enough good people to stem the tide. And we have no excuse in our democratic society to not be involved. There is no excuse for us not to vote. I don't care who you vote for, and I will never tell you from this pulpit who to vote for, but vote. Be involved. That's a freedom you have that many in our world don't. And we ought to be involved. And I think that should even go a step further. I think for those who can have the opportunity to be involved, maybe on the very local level, or it may take you all the way to Washington, D.C. We need good men and women of character, of godly convictions, to be involved in the leadership of our communities, of our state, and of our nation. Somebody once said that in a democracy, you get the government you deserve. You think about that the next time you want to complain about your state government or your federal government. Who put them there? We did. We have an opportunity to be involved. We ought to be involved. You say, yeah, but what can one person do? Well, I want you to consider the story of one named William Wilberforce. His story was told in a movie called Amazing Grace. He was a young member of the British Parliament back in the 1700s. And after entering Parliament, he came to know Jesus Christ in a personal way. And he faced a crisis in his own personal life. Should he stay in Parliament or should he become a preacher? In need of counsel, he went to seek the advice of John Newton. Now, you may have heard of him. He was the son of a sailor. He eventually got involved in the slave trade, and in 1750 was given command of his own ship. But on a especially stormy passage where he is transporting slaves to the West Indies, Newton was converted to faith in Jesus Christ. And if his name may not ring a bell, I'll bet his most famous hymn does. He wrote Amazing Grace. Well, by this time, Newton was himself a preacher in the Church of England. He was renowned for his outspokenness on spiritual matters. And Wilberforce came to him and posed that question, should I stay in Parliament or should I become a preacher? And you might imagine that Newton, being a preacher himself, might encourage this young man to get into the ministry. He did not. He said to him, "The Lord has raised you up to the good of his church and for the good of his nation." And Wilberforce heeded his advice. He worked for many, many years to outlaw the slave trade and eventually slavery altogether in the British Empire. Now, along the way, he met opposition. There was one particular Lord Melbourne who's quoted as saying, "Things have come to a pretty pass when religion is allowed to invade public life." Now, if you think about it, that's what a lot of our politicians are saying today. You keep your faith to yourself. You keep your faith out of the courtrooms and out of the legislative houses. But Wilberforce was not deterred. After outlawing the slave trade in 1807, Wilberforce fought another 18 years for the total emancipation of existing slaves. They were emancipated about 40 or 50 years before American slaves were, largely to the work of William Wilberforce. Despite increasingly poor health, he continued to be a leader for the cause in Parliament until his retirement in 1825. He continued to work for reforms in the prisons, reforms among the poor, reforms in the workplace. And on July 29, 1833, 3 days after the bill for the abolition of slavery passed its second reading in the House of Commons, Wilberforce died. One person can make a difference against the evils of his culture. And this morning's text shows another example of that. One person making a difference. We begin in Esther 2:19. When the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Now, the importance of this incident is sometimes overlooked on the account of its brevity and its style, but it presents new elements into the story that are critical for the development of the plot. It takes some time between Esther's selection as queen in the 7th year of King Xerxes and Haman's plot against the Jews in the 12th year of the king. In form, the report may very well be what was recorded in the annals of the Persians, because it was very succinct. There's no embellishments, there's no exaggerations, there's really no literary finesse. I think Joe Friday would have liked this report. It was just the facts. Now, I mentioned the passage begins when the virgins were assembled a second time. That phrase has stirred a lot of debates among the scholars. There's no specific reference to a first gathering. Joyce Baldwin notes there are almost as many explanations as commentators. You find that a lot of times when you're studying the scriptures. Some would conclude that the text refers to the gathering of all of the women who were in this kind of beauty contest we looked at last week. We were told up to 400 women from all over the Persian Empire were brought to Susa. Each had one night with the king, and he chose one to be his queen. Well, what do you do with the other 399? And some say that this is when those who were not selected were transferred to another part of the palace where the concubines were kept. Others see this as possibly getting the losers, if I can use that word, ready to go back home. But I don't think that was the case. We saw last week, it was common practice, once you were brought in, you stayed. I agree with Warren Wiersbe. He says the second gathering of the virgins probably means that the king's officers continued to gather beautiful girls for the king's harem. For Xerxes wasn't likely to become a monogamist and spend the rest of his life with Esther alone. Queen or no queen, a man like Xerxes wasn't about to release a group of beautiful virgins from his palace. So it's sometime after Esther had been selected, after she had been installed as queen, we find Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. Now, that does not mean that Mordecai was just hanging out by the king's gate, catching up on the latest gossip, or seeing if he could get a handout. This is a technical term. Sitting at the gate meant that you were a part of the activity of that city. The gate was where major commercial and legal transactions were taking place. Markets were held at the gate. The court sat there and to transact its business. Sometimes the king himself would hold court at the gate as people were coming by. We see in Daniel that Daniel sat at the gate of the king as the ruler in Babylon. Now, excavations there at Susa have identified a monumental gatehouse. It was about 100 yards east of the main palace itself. The passageway through the gate was 50 feet long. There were four towers that graced the outside of the structure, and four pillars about 40 feet high decorated the 12,000 square foot chamber through which the passageway entered into the palace complex. They have found an inscription there, ordered by Xerxes himself, that identified it as having been built by his father. Now, according to a Greek historian, Xenophon, all the officials of the Persian king actually lived in the gatehouse. And it was certainly large enough that a number of people could have residence there. So this indicates that Mordecai was some official in the king's government. And when it said he sat at the king's gate, that was where he did his work. That's where he held his office. Now, this was probably done after Esther's coronation. Because you remember, during the process of choosing, Mordecai was walking back and forth to the gate trying to find out how Esther was doing. If he had been part of the king's administration, he could have had access to that information. So I don't think it's too far to suggest that after Esther is installed as queen, she probably used some of her influence to get Mordecai a position there for the king. Again, scholars are not sure exactly what that position was. One Jewish scholar focuses on the word sitting at the gate, suggesting that Mordecai was like a judge or a magistrate, because they would always sit during the proceedings while the different sides would stand. That probably is reading a little too much into the verb, because really it just means to be stationed or to hold office at a particular place. Others suggest he may have been part of the king's bodyguard, or part of his secret police to find out what was going on, because at one verse in Esther 4:1 it says, Mordecai knew everything that was going on in the court. Yeah, maybe that was his job to know what was going on. We're not sure. The Jewish Study Bible insinuates that Mordecai was a member, again, of the king's secret police to ferret out plots. We would call that the Secret Service these days. Another Jewish scholar thinks he was one of the bodyguards themselves. And then one final option is that he was an accountant, because there is an inscription of a man named Marduka, which was the Persian form of Mordecai, who was an accountant and made an inspection tour of Susa during the last years of Darius and the early years of Xerxes. Could have been any of those things. But whatever capacity it was, notice that Mordecai got involved, and that political involvement shows that good men and women can and should participate in whatever governmental position you're able to do. Think of the difference it would make to have godly men and women on our school boards, on our county board, in our city government. Think of what more, because I know there are some already, more godly men and women would do in Springfield and in Washington, in the White House. We need good men and women. If you don't feel you're capable, pray for them. Pray that the Lord would raise up those who would be in service of their country. Because without their presence, who's going to stop or even slow down the evil that invariably rises to power? We see a case in point right here in this text, in Mordecai's practical intervention. Verses 21 to 23 report, during the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on a gallows. Bigthana and Teresh. I mean, just their names sound like thugs, don't they? These are the bad guys. It's possible that Bigthana might be the same person called Bigtha in Esther 1:10. We're not sure. But they were called officers. Literally, in the Hebrew, they were eunuchs, which likely means that they served within the king's home. It says they guarded the doorway. Very likely that was the doorway into his private chambers. And for some reason they were angry with the king. We're not told why. Maybe it had something to do with Queen Vashti being deposed. Maybe they liked Vashti. Maybe they thought that if we got rid of the king, then we could bring back the queen. We're not told. Certainly, these assassination attempts happen quite often. In fact, if we fast forward a little bit, Xerxes himself was assassinated 14 years after this. And it was very similar to this plot. The king's chamberlain allowed the assassins to come into his bedroom, and they murdered him while he slept. So this is certainly not out of the question to take place. We even know that in our own society. Assassination attempts and plots on presidents of the United States have been numerous. There's been more than 20 attempts to kill sitting or former presidents and president-elects. Only 4 presidents have been murdered in office: Abraham Lincoln, James Garfield, William McKinley, and John Kennedy. 2 presidents were injured by gunshot: Theodore Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan. And with the exception of Lyndon Johnson, every president's life since Kennedy has been threatened with assassination. I found it interesting. Though Lincoln was the first president to be assassinated, the first attempt was made about 30 years earlier. On January 30th, 1835, just outside the Capitol building, a house painter named Richard Lawrence attempted to shoot President Andrew Jackson with 2 pistols, but both of them misfired. And the report goes on to say that he was apprehended after the president severely beat him with his cane. Who needs Secret Service? The president could handle himself. They didn't call him Old Hickory for nothing. But after the 1901 assassination of President McKinley, Congress directed that the Secret Service protect the president. And now they're a common fixture around our chief executive and their families. Well, at any rate, Mordecai overhears a plot to assassinate the king. And this is no wild scheme that has no chance of success. And that's what a lot of the plots are today. That's why you don't hear of them in the news. They have zero chance of happening. And they're usually squelched before they get off the ground. But not this one. These 2 men had carefully prepared this conspiracy. And they had the opportunity whenever they wanted. They just had to choose a time. You know, some think this is far-fetched. I don't think it is. This really fits into what was happening there in the ancient world. What we do know is that Mordecai was at the right place at the right time to overhear these plans being made. And he took the information to Queen Esther, who then informed the king. And I wonder, what would we have done? What if that was you? What if you overheard some people saying, you know, I can't stand that governor, I'm going to knock him off. Or, boy, this president, I can't stand the thought of him holding office another day, I'm going to go end it. What would you do? Would you intervene? Should Mordecai have intervened? There are some that say no. One writer put it very bluntly: Mordecai was directly responsible for the grim catastrophe which was about to fall the Jews of Persia. It is a fact of life that our ill deeds cannot be isolated and contained. Mordecai should not have been in an exposed position in which his scheming life had led him. He should not have informed about this plot. It may or may not have done good. Bigthana and Teresh may have had good reason to strike down the beastly creature who ruled Persia. But to Mordecai, they were, for good or ill, 2 expendable pawns in a game of self-seeking. I don't see that at all. I mean, I have a lot of respect for that author, but I think he really missed the boat here. Mordecai did the right thing. And whether or not you like the person in office, respect the office. Pray for that person, even if they disagree with everything you believe in. Pray for that person. We are told in Scripture that God established government. Now, he doesn't pick the people who serve there. We do. Don't blame that on God. But he is the one who has established government. And he has chosen to work that way for there to be law and order in society. And I do not believe that as Christians, we should be involved in plots to overthrow that. You don't find that in the Word of God. During the days after the first Babylonian deportation, Jeremiah admonished the exiles to pray for the city of their captivity. Pray for their rulers. Seek its welfare. He said, it's going to go better for you that way. Many centuries later, when the Jews were living under the harsh yoke of the Roman Empire, there was this attitude of I don't know. I've even heard people today criticize churches that say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, saying, do you think the first century Christians would pledge allegiance to the Roman Empire? Well, if they were listening to Paul and Peter, I think they would. We see in 1 Peter 2:13 to 17, Peter says, be subject to those in authority over you, even to those who are harsh. It doesn't matter if they're your party or not. It doesn't matter if they agree with you on all of your stands. We are to submit to them. Paul says to the Christians in Rome, in Romans 13, submit to the governmental authorities, both to avoid their wrath, but also to have a clear conscience before God. One author puts it this way, honor and respect are due earthly leaders, not because they're powerful or influential men, but because they've been appointed by God. It follows that to treat them with less than the honor they're due is to dishonor God. An honor without its practical corollary of the due payment of taxes for the maintenance of the authority would be a mockery. We may not like what they do. We may not like what they stand for. But government itself, by principle, is something established by God. And we are commanded to pray for it, to participate in it, and to submit to it. The circumstances surrounding this book of Esther, they were somewhat different than what existed when Peter and Paul were writing. But I don't know that they were that dissimilar. Nero isn't a far cry from Xerxes if you get right down to it. And I think that we live in a country where we have been blessed with great freedoms of religion, freedoms of expression. Now, if we don't stand up for them, we may lose them in the not too distant future, which is another reason why we need to be involved. And I'm not saying that we should obey men when they command us to disobey God. But overall in our nation, I think we ought to respect the office and pray for the men and women who hold them. I don't believe in any way that Mordecai was self-seeking in sparing the king's life. I think he really stuck his neck out. I mean, what if Bigthana and Teresh heard that he was the one that told his life would be in danger? And it may not have just been those two involved in the plot. There may have been a larger conspiracy. They could come after Mordecai, but he did the right thing regardless of the cost. And once the investigation was found to be true, they dispatched the would-be assassins quickly. They didn't mess around back then with a lot of appeals and all of that. It was handled very swiftly. The text says that the two officials were hanged on a gallows. Now, we usually think of the Old West, right? You got the gallows out on Main Street, and the bad guy, they put a rope around his neck and drop the lever, and there he is. That's not what they meant by gallows back then. Gallows here really just means a wooden object. There's no indication at all in ancient history that they executed someone by putting a noose around their neck and allowing him to strangle. Really, the word here is impaled. And they would get a stake, they would sharpen it, and then they would just impale the body on it and leave it out for everybody to see. In fact, it's unlikely that that's how they killed them. Usually they did that with a dead body. So they were put to death and then impaled on a pole so that everybody could see it and say, this is what happens if you mess with the king. I know a lot of people say capital punishment is not a deterrent. I've yet to be convinced of that. Now, there's other arguments in that whole question, but it certainly has an effect when people see what happens to those who stand against the king. Now, could you imagine the headlines of the Susa Sun Times after all this? I mean, Mordecai saves the day, right? Mordecai spares the king. Big old picture of Mordecai right on the front page. Never happened. We're told in the text that all this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. And that was it. Mordecai wasn't even thanked for his trouble. Now, he might have received a title called benefactor to the king, as Herodotus describes it. And they had one privilege. They did not have to bow before anybody except the king himself. That may come into play in the next chapter when we're introduced to Haman. But other than that, nothing is done. Mordecai is not rewarded in any way. He's not heralded before the people. And it's interesting that Mordecai's unrewarded deed contrasts very sharply in the very next verse in chapter 3 with Haman's unexplained advancement. You would think Mordecai was the one who would get the advancement, but Haman gets one for no apparent reason. He received neither recognition nor reward for saving the king's life. But no matter, God saw to it that the facts were permanently recorded, and he would make good use of them at the right time. And that's a lesson for us today. Our good works are like seeds that are planted by faith, and their fruits don't always appear immediately. You don't always get recognized and rewarded for the good things you do. In fact, we have a saying in our culture, no good deed goes unpunished. That's Murphy's Law, and oftentimes that seems to be the case. But we read in Proverbs 13:21, evil pursues sinners, but to the righteous good shall be repaid. Think about Joseph. He befriended a fellow prisoner, but then the man completely forgot about it for 2 years. But at just the right time, God brought it back to the fore, and Joseph was rewarded. You know, Mordecai could have reminded Xerxes of the oversight. Hey, king, remember a couple months ago I saved your neck? Probably not a good idea, especially what we know of King Xerxes. But maybe it was a sign of his faith. He was willing to wait and see when and whether he would have his reward. He put it into the hands of God. And the same is true for us. Our faithfulness to God is not always immediately rewarded. We don't always get the pat on the back. We do not always get the recognition for the good things that we do. That's okay. As Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, God who sees what is done in secret will reward you openly. He just doesn't say when. And think about it. Wouldn't you rather receive your reward in heaven, in front of God's throne, be recognized there? I mean, yeah, it's great to be recognized here on earth, but how much greater to be rewarded by your heavenly Father in person when we stand before his throne. As Psalm 31:15 states, our times are in his hands. Faith is living without scheming. Don't try to force God's hand into something that you want now. God has perfect timing. It's not our timing, but it is perfect. It's as God's people commit themselves to God's purposes that we can discern God's providence at work. One author concludes this way: it is sometimes difficult for us to wish well government leaders whose policies we oppose. Indeed, it is not uncommon to hear Christians make disparaging and even hateful comments about people who have been elected to high office. The examples of a number of biblical heroes, however, would put us to shame. King Xerxes was no paragon of virtue. He was a pagan, and as depicted here, not especially competent. Yet Mordecai rescued the king from danger and even worked as his close advisor. Daniel, too, worked within the administrations of Nebuchadnezzar, the despoiler of Jerusalem, and equally tyrannical successors. Through the ages, Christians have disagreed and even fought over the relationship between believers and civil authorities. Many of the faithful live under the rule of tyrants, infidels, or incompetents. When we hear of the hardships of our brothers and sisters, we may well think that our only recourse is military intervention, take up arms, get violent. The church has often been tempted in one way or another to force civil authorities to bow to its authority. The scriptures, however, are unambiguous in their counsel that the responsibility to bow is ours. Bow, pray, and avoid the temptation to seize power illegally. Our weapons are spiritual, not political. Remember, our enemy's not human. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood. Our enemies are not Democrats. Neither are they Republicans. We are all Americans. We are all Christians. And as such, we have a responsibility to be involved to the extent that we can without violating God's standards. Whoever may hold earthly power, we know that in whatever we do, we are in the service of the King. And he will reward us. If not now, he will eventually.